Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 11th, 2006. This is Stephen Novella, your host and president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me today are Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, all.
Perry DeAngelis.
Righto.
And Robert Novella.
Buongiorno.
How are you guys doing this evening?
Good, Steve.
Not too bad.
What's going on?
Oh, well.
So I just wanted to open the show with a message to a gentleman in Arizona by the name of Michael Morticelli. Believe it or not, this guy, I was skeptical at first when I heard this, but this guy actually listens to our podcast.
Unbelievable.
Can you believe it?
He might be I do
believe
fan.
It.
Also our only shock, but hey, guys, thanks for listening, buddy.
He actually gets a little cranky when we're late uploading the podcasts.
As well he should.
Sent us a threatening email. So we'll continue to try to get them out on time, Mike. Don't worry about it. So, in Germany, there is a movie that's going to be released soon with a new theory about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, a topic that, unlike the president, a topic that will not die. almost from the moment of his assassination, there have been conspiracy theories surrounding the assassination of JFK. Many of them surround either the mafia or agencies within our own government, the Soviet Union, and Cuba. Basically, the premise of these conspiracy theories are that somebody had to benefit from Kennedy's assassination, and then they commit the logical fallacy called the argument from final consequences. If somebody benefited, well, they must have been responsible for it then. Or if somebody had a motive to kill him, then they must have been responsible. Unfortunately for these conspiracy theorists, over the last 40 years, there hasn't been a shred of evidence, you know, come to light that implicates anyone other than Lee Harvey Oswald as the so-called lone gunman. I think the best summary of the entire topic was the book Case Closed by Gerald Posner. You guys familiar with that book? He's spoken for us a couple of times.
Spoken for us several times. Yeah.
Yeah, very articulate, impeccably researched book. Really was very impressed by the scholarship. He's a journalist, but just did a ton of research, and his book was excellent.
Well, it says the maker of this new film, Wilford Heisman, or Hoosman, is also a journalist. By the way, the name of the film is Rendezvous with Death, Why Kennedy Had to Die.
It sounds like the basic premise is that Castro and Kennedy were trying to bump each other off, and Castro won, basically. That the Kennedys decided that they needed to remove Castro from power, and in retaliation, Castro put the hit out on Kennedy.
Well, they did. The Kennedys did actually contemplate it, and
sure,
they go through some plans about ways they could actually get rid of him. Some bizarre plans, like poisoning his cigars, or actually making him—I think it was something like making him lose his beard
beard fall out. Yeah,
right. Because they put so much, you know, there's so much prestige, you know, and so much machismo in a beard that if he lost it, it would be like other men losing another part of them that they, you know, would make them fall.
Right,
the
right. So the core of the movie revolves around the fact that Oswald visited Mexico shortly before he assassinated JFK, and he did so. He was trying to get to Cuba through the Cuban embassy in Mexico. This is all known. This all came out in the investigation after the assassination. The Cubans basically
didn't. Warren Report, was that what?
The Warren Report was the official,
government
investigation of it. Basically, from what I understand, is the Cubans didn't want him because he was kind of, you know, a nerd and a jerk, and they wouldn't let him come into the country. He did live in the Soviet Union for a while, but then became dissatisfied with the Soviet Union and returned to the United States. So he was basically just an all-around malcontent that nobody wanted much to do with. A very typical profile of somebody who, you know, in an effort to redeem themselves from abject mediocrity, you know, they do something dramatic, like, you know, assassinate the president. And but there is, the movie does not actually present any new evidence tying Oswald to Castro or to Cuba. It is simply a reinterpretation of evidence that has already existed and been known, just, you know, weaving it together in a new conspiracy theory, you know, now being added to the probably hundreds that are that have been, you know, printed since the assassination, but no actual new evidence.
That's a fine documentary for you.
Right.
I mean, they couldn't even try to pretend and make up some evidence?
I don't know. I mean, actually, maybe we could see the movie. I don't know if there'll be an English translation at some point.
I'm sure there will be.
Yeah, there probably will be.
I'm sure there will be.
Also, apparently, they present as evidence some what is essentially hearsay, the idea that Johnson, President Johnson, who succeeded Kennedy, believed that Castro was involved in Kennedy's assassination, even if true, is still just one man's belief. He didn't have access to any evidence that was not examined by the Warren
right.
Commission. It really was just his paranoia. It does also make reference to the fact that there are still documents that were reviewed by the Warren Commission that were sealed until 2039 by executive order of President Johnson. Although some of these records, I think, on the 1992 Assassinations Records Review Board basically said that that some of the documents related to the assassination can be released to the public in 2017. So there are some documents that are not in the public domain that will come out over time. And, you know, it would be very interesting to see what they hold.
Steve, did the Warren Commission have access to these documents?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So they based their conclusions on that.
Yes. So yeah, these are not documents that were hidden from the commission that investigated
right.
the assassination.
So it's not like these are going to come out and people are going to be like, oh, well, how obvious, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there'll be a new round of conspiracy theory books once they do come out. Just
yeah, but it can't be anything too dramatic.
Why seal them for so long? What's the point of that?
I don't know. I assume we'll find out when they're released.
I guess.
I assume it has something to do with national security, you know. Documents that reveal our methods of spying and networks.
The world
et cetera,
is so different now, you know.
It's true. It's hard to imagine that there were any secrets in place 40 years ago that would compromise us at this time, but I guess they wanted to put the date sufficiently far in the future that there would be no chance that there would be any security liability.
Also, I think another factor might also be that all parties involved by then will be dead.
Right.
Anybody.
There won't be any personal embarrassment to
right.
anybody. Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. So a story that won't go away. I wonder how long it will last. Interestingly, just from a historical context point of view, did you guys realize that after Lincoln was assassinated, for a generation following his assassination, there were swirling conspiracy theories about that too?
No,
I did not know that.
There were. It was the same exact thing happened. I mean, it wasn't the multimedia that we have today, but basically there were all sorts of theories, including, you know, fraudulent autopsy results, basically a lot of mystery mongering, looking for all the little details of the official story that didn't quite make sense. At one point, one detail I remember, at one point somebody claimed that there were two bullet holes in Lincoln's brain, and Wilkes Booth was only supposed to have shot him in the head once. So they go, aha, there must have been a second shooter if there was another bullet hole in the brain, and two people makes a conspiracy. Very similar argument that's levied against the Kennedy assassination.
Well, probably bounced around in there.
No, what actually happened, this is, you know, remember pre-X-ray, pre-modern, you know, medical imaging devices. So in a forensic autopsy of a gunshot wound, The pathologist would do a procedure that was called sounding. They would sound the location of the bullet. They would pass a probe through the bullet hole, the pathway of the bullet, to measure the depth of the bullet in the brain or in the whatever tissue they were investigating. And the pathologist, because the brain is like jello, it's very squishy, it's not very firm. He passed the probe through the brain tissue and sort of deviated from the path of the bullet. He essentially made a second pathway with the probe to the bullet, which then, upon later inspection by somebody else, made it look like there were two holes in the brain. But the second one was just created by the pathologist. So anyway, there's lots of little details like that, you know, that were used to argue that there was actually some governmental or whatever, some inside conspiracy to assassinate Lincoln.
I can only imagine the McKinley assassination had some sort of similar following, even if not to any extent that the others. But
I don't know. Not that I've heard about, but I've never really read about the McKinley assassination.
Just yesterday, the guy that tried to assassinate President Bush with a grenade. When he was in Russia.
He was in Georgia, I think.
Georgia, Vladimir Aruti, and he was sentenced to life in jail.
Mm-hmm.
He also killed a cop when they were trying to arrest him.
Is that right?
That guy, yeah.
Oswald killed the cop, too.
Did he?
There you go.
He gets around.
when they were trying to arrest him.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, that's correct. He did.
This guy said if he were free, he tried to kill the president again.
What's this?
That's the end of that.
There you go.
He's not thinking about parole.
No.
Lock me up for life, please. Thank you.
So does that mean Jack Ruby was also working with the Cubans because they hired him to get rid of Oswald?
Yeah, you know, Posner writes about that. You know, the fact that Jack Ruby, who shot Lee Harvey Oswald on live television, you know, a couple of days after he was arrested, it certainly looks like a silencing. You know, that they were getting rid of the trigger man so that he couldn't talk. But if you investigate Jack Ruby. He also was kind of like a mobster nerd in that he was a wannabe, but he was such a loser that nobody wanted anything to do with him, and he was pretty psychotic, you know, especially in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination. So, you know, his behavior was very erratic and really explainable just on the basis of his personality, and he didn't really have any credible ties to Cuba, certainly, or, you know, even to the mob or to anyone that would have, you know, given him instructions to assassinate Oswald. But another very, very historically very interesting wrinkle in the whole thing, and certainly lends itself tremendously to the conspiracy theorists. Because conspiracies in general, just to talk about that for a minute, I mean, they tend, the grand conspiracies, you know, tend to collapse under their own weight because they require so much power and cleverness on the part of the people carrying out the conspiracy that they really become intrinsically implausible. And at the same time, the absence of any direct evidence for the conspiracy gets dismissed as being part of the conspiracy, so it becomes this insulated, unfalsifiable sort of belief system.
Bulletproof.
Right. So essentially what conspiracy theorists are left to do is they look for anomalies or apparent anomalies, things that don't immediately make sense, and then they conclude from those anomalies that there must have been a conspiracy surrounding, you know, those events. The same thing applies to many, many pseudosciences. You know, mystery mongering or just anomaly hunting does not add up to positive evidence for a specific explanation, whether it's a conspiracy or aliens or some specific pseudoscientific or paranormal explanation. So that's, you know, that's the essence of why most of these grand conspiracy theories are basically pseudoscientific in their structure. But why don't we move on? We do have a science or fiction for this week. We have no guests, so shows where we don't have a guest, I typically fill in with a science or fiction.
Won't be the case next week, by the way.
Next week we do have a guest. We'll talk about that at the end of the episode.
All
preview
right.
That a bit.
It's time to play Science or Fiction.
The science or fiction, for those of you who don't know, what I do is I come up with three news items in science, either science facts or science news items. Two of them are genuine, mostly recent scientific news items, and one is fictitious. I make up one. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to try to sniff out which one is fake and which two are real, and of course, you listeners can play along with us. There is a theme for this week. I like to do themes. The theme this week is black holes.
Ooh.
I know you guys all know what black holes are, right? They're massive astronomical objects that are essentially massive dead stars that were large enough that their own gravity compresses them down to a single point called a singularity. Oftentimes astronomers will to describe the size of a black hole, and what they're not talking about the size of where the mass is condensed into, because again, that's a single, it's always a single point. What they're talking about is the size of the event horizon. The event horizon is the point within which, so the distance from the singularity, where even light itself cannot escape the gravitational pull of that black hole. So if you fall within the event horizon, you are forever trapped by the black hole.
Now, of course, you have photographic evidence of these black holes you claim exist.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, Evan, because I often use black holes as an example of the fact that even though I'm a skeptic, you know, the true believers often say, well, don't you believe in anything that you can't see with your
right.
own eyes? And I say,
that's
sure,
right.
I believe, I accept the probable reality of black holes, even though I've seen one, and in fact, no one has ever seen a black hole.
Right.
We infer their existence by seeing, multiple independent lines of evidence, but primarily, there's a theoretical basis for their existence, and there's also indirect observational evidence in that we can see their gravitational effect on nearby stuff, whether it's stars or matter or whatever.
As exotic as they are, there really is no doubt in any astronomer's or physicist's mind that these do in fact exist.
Yeah, I mean the evidence is at the point where this is a fairly well-established fact.
What did Gould say? It would be perverse to not believe in them?
It would be perverse to withhold provisional assent.
Okay.
That's as good as you get in science.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to give you three recent discoveries about black holes, and you have to tell me which one is fake. Interestingly, I'll tell you before, in the past sometimes I've run into trouble because the fake ones I've made up were distressingly close to the truth.
Like Da Vinci's calculating machine.
Right, but that one we never aired, by the way, for technical reasons. But I did a previous science or fiction about Da Vinci, and like I said, the following things are things that Da Vinci invented, and the one that I made up was a calculating machine. And it turns out that there was a recent discovery of a new book of his that was in Madrid, where in fact he did design a calculating machine. So my fake Da Vinci invention was actually true. So this time, when I was thinking of my fake ones, I did a more thorough research to make sure that none of these things were actually out there, and the first one that I came up with actually existed, and I couldn't use it as my fake one. I'll tell you what it was after when we're at the end. So here's the first one. You guys ready?
Yep.
Ready.
Yep.
Okay. Fact number one. Scientists have discovered evidence that a massive black hole is actually warping space and time, as predicted by Einstein's general theory of relativity. So they've observed the warping of space and time around a probable black hole. Fact number two, which I call the lonely black hole. Astronomers have discovered a supermassive black hole that appears to have been ejected from its home galaxy. Just for a bit of background, many galaxies have supermassive black holes at their core, in the middle of the galaxy. Astronomers have discovered a black hole that was ejected from its galaxy, so it's now by itself, without its surrounding galaxy.
How about the Milky Way?
The Milky Way has a supermassive black hole at its core, yes.
Absolutely.
And number three, astronomers have discovered a small black hole within our solar system, meaning that it's closer to our star than any other star. Those are the three items. Evan, why don't we start with you?
My God. You know, if three turns out to be truthful, I think that's just incredible. In our own solar system, I mean, cosmically speaking, that's like having it might as well be next door.
Right. But, I mean, you know, that goes out to 2 light years, basically.
Yeah, but still. Right. Still, that's pretty darn close. I don't know. It almost seems too obvious that would be the one that you made up. So I'm going to say that one's right. And for no other reason, it's really a coin flip for me between one and two. So I'm going to say one is not is false.
Okay. Perry?
Yeah, you know, like one in three, scientists would have a hard time observing what you claim they observed in number one. And number three just seems highly improbable. But I'm going to go with the obvious one and say number three. Seems very unlikely.
Okay. Alrighty. Bob?
Alright, well, Warping Space and Time, the first one. Einstein did postulate that. I believe it's called frame dragging. They've actually launched some satellites to test that, that are in orbit around the Earth that will test his theory, and I don't think the jury's in on that one, but it seems very plausible to me. I'm not sure. Initially, it would seem to me that black holes would be too far away to actually observe some frame dragging around them, but it's entirely possible. Let's see, the second one, supermassive black hole ejected from a home galaxy. Initially, I thought, well, how would that happen? But galaxies collide very often, and if a black hole would be ejected, it would probably be from a collision with another galaxy. I could see that happening. Although it would probably drag a fair amount of the galaxy with it, I would think, but it depends how close it is to the stars in the core. The small black hole within our solar system, no way. No way. I would have heard about that. First off, you said it was a small black hole. There are theories of small black holes, primordial black holes that are real tiny, and the black holes do evaporate over time, Hawking radiation.
Right.
Black holes do evaporate, and if they would theoretically reach a certain size and then explode in a shower of radiation once they reached a certain critical threshold of size. If there was a very small black hole within a couple light years, I don't know how the hell you would detect it. First off, it's pretty small. There's not much out there for them to actually infer its existence. So I would have to say that is absolutely false. And if it's not false,
okay,
I'll be so happy anyway. I won't care.
Right. Well, you got, now you know why I always make Bob go last, especially when I'm doing an astronomy topic. I basically knew Bob would be all over this one. So I'll just cut right to the chase. Number three is the one that I made up.
I knew it.
Yes, but I chose it.
Yeah.
You did. I got Evan. I mean, Evan sort of used the
too obvious.
It was too obvious, but it was obvious because it was in fact the correct answer. So Bob's analysis, I think, was pretty accurate all around. Number one, observing the warping of space and time as predicted by the general theory of relativity. In fact, that is a recent discovery using a NASA X-ray satellite. They observed X-rays passing near, basically past a black hole, right? So the source of the X-rays is behind the black hole. And they have observed periodic, what they call quasi-periodic oscillations in these in this X-ray light, which matches really well to the predicted distortions or warping of space and time that would occur around a black hole.
Cool.
So, yeah, so that's pretty good observational confirmation of a lot of the theories behind black holes. So that's one thing. That's just that was plausible. It's just a matter of just knowing that news item. The second one I thought was interesting. So, and Bob, again, you were exactly right. In fact, it was ejected from its host galaxy, probably by the collision of two galaxies. So when two galaxies collide, that gravitational interaction whipped the black hole away from its parent galaxy. And it also, as you suggested, Bob, it dragged a lot of the galaxy with it. So it's still surrounded by a core of material that it's feeding off of.
Cool.
And in fact, it would have to be, otherwise we couldn't see it.
Right, exactly.
Because then it's the material which is being eaten, if you will, by the black hole that's being dumped into the black hole, which then ejects gamma rays and radiation, and that's what we see. In fact, it's thought that that's what quasars are. Quasars are, in fact, the brightest, oldest objects that we can observe. They're probably at the edge of the known universe, and it is theorized that they represent, you know, supermassive black holes in the cores of young galaxies. In fact, this thing looks a lot like a quasar, but there's no galaxy around it. So that was an enigma for a while, but now they figured out that it's probably because it was just ejected from its galaxy by two galaxies colliding. The third item, a small black hole in our solar system. I didn't think I was really going to fool anybody that much by saying it was small, but yeah, there are are no black holes in our vicinity that have ever been detected. Even a small one...
It's probably a good thing.
Would be a scary thing, yeah. I mean, they have to be really, really small. Black holes do evaporate and do get smaller over time, so there could be some out there. But then Bob raised the obvious question, how would we really know about it? I mean, they would have to be surrounded by a disk of material, otherwise you wouldn't really be able to see them. But just to be thorough, I did a thorough search on that question to see if there was any NASA or astronomical data, you know, because the way you could observe them, even if you couldn't see them because of close by material, you could see them because of their gravitational influence on other objects.
Yeah, but
so I mean, perhaps the perturbation in the orbit of Pluto or something could hypothetically be due to a small black hole,
right,
you know, way out, you know, beyond the Oort cloud or something.
Still, I think you'd be pretty safe not doing too much investigation on that one. That would be huge news. I mean, that would be my God.
It would, but I wanted, you know, I got burned on on the other one.
And there's always tomorrow.
The Da Vinci calculator, so I wanted to make sure I didn't get burned on this one. But I did find one website that actually talked about exactly that, but it was purely speculative. There was no evidence of it. It was just somebody saying, you know, maybe there's a black hole out there that's perturbing the orbit of Pluto.
Or Sedna.
or the other, the
unnamed
other
one, yeah.
Now the my first choice of a fake answer turned out to actually be true, which is somewhat obvious. I just hadn't heard about it myself, and I was going to say that there was the discovery of a binary black hole, two black holes orbiting each other.
Oh, cool!
Ooh.
But in fact, those have already been discovered.
I don't think it would last too long, depending on their
right. Eventually they will merge. They will merge eventually. So that is not an entirely stable system. But there are some observed binary black holes or two black holes orbiting closely around each other.
Boy, would they release tons of gravitational waves if they
yes,
really exist?
Exactly. They do.
How are black holes related to antimatter, if at all?
There's no direct or obvious relationship. There may be some exotic relationship.
There is a relationship, actually. I believe certain classes of black holes, I think the only requirement is that they're very active. There's lots of debris in their immediate vicinity. Black holes, I believe, can actually produce antimatter jets that exit the galaxy at right angles to the plane of the galaxy. So I think they have actually found jets of antimatter, you know, being squirted out of certain galaxies.
How would you define antimatter, Bob?
They're mirror images of particles that we know of all particles, but their charge is the opposite. So an electron has a negative charge, an antimatter electron would be a positron, which would be which would have a positive charge, and of course, the theory goes that if they meet, they annihilate each other, really, you know, converting their mass into 100% energy, which of course would be immense. You know, if you look at Einstein.
Well, that's more than a theory. I mean,
we've
made small amounts of antimatter. That's in fact what happens.
Yeah, but I mean,
particles and antiparticles essentially annihilate each other.
I mean, I don't know if you probably could still call it a theory. I don't think anyone's actually mixed matter and antimatter together to see what would actually happen. But like other theories, it's so well accepted that there's really no question.
I mean, I thought they had manufactured small amounts of antimatter.
Yeah, they have. They do. They can create.
So they know what
happens to it. But yeah, have they actually? I'm not sure what they do with it, though. Have they actually put it in contact with regular matter to see what would happen? That'd probably be a cool experiment if you had small amounts.
I think it's really hard for them to keep it from going into contact with regular matter.
Yeah, they used to keep
it isolated in magnetic fields and
right.
Whatnot.
I've just never read of them actually doing that experiment. And well, maybe they did. So you're right. It's probably not just a theory. I mean, there's really no question.
But it happens in particle accelerators. The antiparticles exist for a very short period of time. They don't accumulate antimatter. Antimatter is produced and then almost immediately destructs itself, annihilates a matter particle.
Yeah, certain collisions.
So that happens all the time.
Yeah, certain collisions produce particles and antiparticles which go away from each other and then curve back in to each other and then annihilate each other. So,
right,
yeah, it's not just a theory. I mean, it happens all the time. That's right, particle
accelerators. Right. But black holes are cool. They're very exotic. It's my favorite example of, you know, believing in things that are absolutely fantastical, counterintuitive. We can only really infer their existence. And it's really a good answer to all the true believers who think that skeptics can only believe things that are right in front of their face. It's also a good example of why science is cooler than fiction, you know?
Right.
There's no one in the world of the paranormal or even science fiction has come up with anything as neat as what real science is producing.
Absolutely.
So that was our science or fiction for this week, but let's change topics now to talk about freedom of speech. We try not to get bogged down in purely political issues on the Skeptic's Guide. We'd like to always be some, you know, scientific or paranormal angle, but we do get very interested in the whole issue of freedom of speech, especially academic freedom of speech, which often now runs afoul of the beast known as political correctness. There is a group called the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. They have a website, www.thefire.org, and they are a self-appointed watchdog group on colleges and universities that infringe upon individual rights, especially, you know, First Amendment free speech rights. They have an award that they give out called the Speech Code of the Month Award, which is given to a college or university that has trampled upon these free rights. And I think, Perry, you sent me this one, their latest Speech Code of the Month, the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts.
All right. I imagine they have many, many to choose from. I would not be surprised.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about this this one piece?
Right. So they're mentioning in this particular piece about the student handbook at the Massachusetts College for Liberal Arts, which is a public college. And the quote in there that they pull out is, "There shall be no interference with a demonstration on the grounds of content of speech, except for any speech or demonstration which victimizes others because the speech contains offensive language and or is motivated by hate or bias." So that means that unless it offends somebody, that they're not going to interfere unless it offends somebody.
Right.
Which, you know, it's totally subjective and it's too overreaching. To the point of silliness.
It is silly. I mean, the idea that people can demonstrate as long as they don't offend anyone is absurd, and the idea is that again they get to decide if the demonstration is motivated by hate or bias. Bias. I mean, what is that?
Talk about a broad stroke.
It is essentially so broad that it gives them, you know, the leeway to essentially police the content of speech on campus.
And they'll accept bias, by the way, as long as it's biased towards what they believe in.
Right.
Which, in most cases, is a left or a liberal agenda.
Probably.
In the world of academia, that's the usual.
Statistically.
Not always, but the typical.
The article quotes the U.S. Supreme Court in a relevant decision. This is Terminiello versus Chicago, 1949. It's going back a little bit. I assume, I don't know if this is still a contemporary precedent, but it says, "Speech is often provocative and challenging. It may strike at prejudices and preconceptions and have profound unsettling effects as it presses for acceptance of an idea. That is why freedom of speech, though not absolute, is nevertheless protected against censorship or punishment, unless shown likely to produce a clear and present danger of a serious substantive evil that rises far above public inconvenience, annoyance, or unrest." So even if speech will cause unrest or inconvenience or annoyance or basically offend somebody, that's not enough to say that to infringe upon the freedom of speech. It has to have a clear and present danger of a substantive evil. I know in more recent cases, basically the application of that has been that if you are inciting a crowd to criminal or hostile activity, that speech is not protected.
Right.
So, and I know that that may come up in cases of, you know, like if the KKK is having a rally and inciting people, you know, to murder, they can't defend that as free speech. But that certainly is not anything close to what this college's student handbook is talking about. You know, something which they subjectively decide is biased. That's just ludicrous.
Oh, they consider skepticism biased, you know, or anything, really.
Yeah, I mean, the skeptics face this all the time because we are often told that, you know, our opinions are hurtful or there's some way rude. You know, it's rude to tell people that their beliefs are wrong. And it would be easy to see that that the kind of speech that we would advocate would be censored by these kinds of things. In fact, one of our members informed me once that I don't remember what the school was, but the school had a filter on their internet access, and the NES website was filtered out of by their filter. So essentially, students at that school could not access our website because it must have somehow triggered their censorship filters.
Ridiculous.
I mean, again, it's probably because of all the pornography we have on our website, right?
That's right.
We do.
All the incendiary hate talk we have, and our absolute prejudice toward against gullibility.
Well, I do think that it's good to have organizations like this out there. I do think that freedom of speech is one of the most important, you know, rights guaranteed in the Constitution because. It is such a tremendous strength of our culture, of our society, that we can have, that we actually celebrate a free exchange of ideas, even ideas which are uncomfortable or unpopular, and that we don't try to insulate ourselves from ideas that we don't like. Especially since that actually is the natural human tendency. People tend to expose themselves to ideas that they already agree with and tend to insulate themselves from ideas which challenge what they believe. So you would imagine that over time the statutes and laws would reflect that basic human psychology unless, you know, in more enlightened times we went out of our way to protect information and speech that was potentially either unpopular or even, you know, quote-unquote offensive. So anyway, I mean, I think that it is absolutely critical to continue to be, you know, very staunchly dedicated to the free exchange of intellectual ideas, which, you know, actually, you know, leads to the next topic that I wanted to talk about tonight. It is no news that the Iranian government, which is pretty hardline and very anti-Israel, anti-Israeli,
anti-intellectual, too.
Well, that's true.
Let's face it.
Anti-lots of things.
They have, and specifically the Iranian president, Mahmoud
Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad.
Okay. That he essentially...
call him Mahmoud.
Mahmoud denies the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust of World War II. Of course, not the first or only person to do that.
What motivation could he possibly have to want to deny the Holocaust?
Well, it actually goes beyond that, Steve. He has spoken outwardly of hosting a conference about the Holocaust, in which he's inviting scholars from around the world to come to Iran to discuss the Holocaust, both those who feel it was truly an event that happened in history and for those who have their doubts as to whether or not it happened. And, you know, it's pretty shocking to hear.
Right.
Certainly when I read it for the first time. It tries to bring the denial of the Holocaust to a certain level of accuracy that it by no means in any respect deserves to be brought up to any kind of playing field against the historical facts. The Holocaust absolutely happened. There's, you know, the evidence is overwhelming. You know, we still have survivors of the Holocaust, certainly to give
right.
their personal accounts. And my uncle being one of those as a boy, he was imprisoned and managed to escape one of the concentration camps, which is a story for another time.
I think at this point it would be perverse to withhold your provisional assent.
Well, here's a quote from President Mahmoud of Iran that he has placed at the center of... I'm sorry, this is not a quote from him. This is a quote from a spokesman of the Association of Islamic Journalists, that the president has placed at the center of international attention a very important question on the truthfulness of the version that Europe and the Zionists have imposed on the world on the murder of Jews during the years of the Great War. And therefore, we are of the opinion that it is useful and necessary to organize an international conference on that theme, where all the historians and researchers, even those that do not believe the official version, will be able to express themselves freely. So, you know, clearly he's... you know, betraying his position in this statement that this is a myth, that an official, you know, a myth that's been imposed upon the world by Europe and Zionists, and that they need to protect those, you know, historians who express doubt about the, you know, the official version of the Holocaust.
Yeah, but guys, doesn't, what about Germany? I mean, don't Germans say, yeah, we did it? I mean, don't they admit it?
Yes.
I mean, but
oh, yes.
Still, they discount
make,
that as well.
They have
they
some,
go
the harshest
that.
Laws, some of the harshest laws in the world about Holocaust denial. I mean, they'll imprison you if you publish things in Germany, if you say things on the radio, if you try to even express your opinion on it.
Right.
That's it. They'll arrest you and put you in jail.
Did Germany
in
have
fact,
an official response to this statement? I mean, you'd think they would have said
not
something.
Not that I've seen. But Evan is right. In fact, there is a prominent Holocaust denier who is sitting in, it's actually an Austrian jail. Austria has similar laws to Germany for expressing, you know, doubt about the Holocaust, essentially what we call Holocaust denial.
Hitler was Austrian, by the way.
It is David Irving. He's an English historian. David right. Irving, who is a notorious Holocaust denier, is currently in the custody of an Austrian jail, being accused of denying the Holocaust. Now, of course, I totally disagree with that policy. I mean, I don't think that you should put somebody in jail for being an idiot and for being wrong. We should, you know, hash out their claims in academic arenas, you know, not put them in jail for denying. The government shouldn't ever be the final say on what's
true.
Truth and what's not truth.
It's a hypersensitivity issue on the part of, you
right.
know, Germans and Austrians.
Right.
You know, and you put yourselves in, I guess, their shoes, and, you know, they're just trying, I think, to make any effort possible to atone as much as possible for as long as they possibly can, the atrocities under Hitler and the Third Reich.
Right, but I don't think oppressing academic freedom is the way to accomplish that.
I happen to agree with that.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
Certainly we could see why they're doing that. They're also, you know, very sensitive about cults. They don't have the same religious freedoms that we have constitutionally protected in this country, and therefore they feel free to outlaw, like Scientology is basically outlawed in Germany. It's outlawed under their rules, which have illegalized fascist organizations, and basically they have deemed Scientology to be a fascist organization, and it's illegal in Germany. In fact, during the Clinton administration, not Tom Cruise, but the other one, John Travolta. Yeah, John Travolta actually petitioned the Clinton administration to put pressure on Germany for human rights violations, and the human rights violations that he was concerned with was their oppression of Scientology within that country. So, again, I disagree with Germany for violating the religious freedom of Scientologists, even though I think that Scientology is a vicious and ridiculous cult, you know. But, again, that's the sort of the double-edged sort of freedom. You know, people have the freedom to be idiots. And I'd rather educate them than criminalize their idiocy.
What Iran is doing, though, is they're kind of bringing this back into, because Iran is so prominent in the news right now, to dig up to lump into this now the Holocaust revisionist aspect of what they're trying to do really puts it on the front page of the newspapers worldwide in a very, very dangerous time in the world's history right now.
I agree, but I think the danger is probably within the Islamic community. I think worldwide, the historians have spoken. The evidence is out there. All the claims of the Holocaust revisionists are out there. They've been dissected. They're nonsense. They're logical fallacies. Their evidence is wrong. So I don't think there's, like, any danger of that sort of spreading to the population at large. It's always been mainly popular among sort of neo-fascists or neo-Nazis, you know, in Europe and in America, and people who already, you know, basically were anti-Semitic. But the Islamic community has demonstrated their willingness and their ability to believe any nonsense which is being told to them by their leaders and from the pulpit. I mean, there after 9/11, there were rumors that were spreading wildly and believed widely among the Islamic communities that the bombing of the Twin Towers was a Jewish conspiracy, and that all of the Jewish workers stayed home that day, that they did not show up for work at the Twin Towers because they knew it was coming. And that was widely believed.
Probably still is.
Probably still is.
Well, that's just they never go away. They never go away.
So you're dealing with a culture that is in many places very backward, very almost medieval in their societal and belief structures, and they don't have the free press that we have here, and they're isolated and they're insulated a lot more than obviously a more open society is like what we have. So when a religious figure says preaches in the mosques that this is the way it is, that the Holocaust didn't happen, it's a Zionist lie and myth that they use in order to essentially manipulate the world into creating Israel, which is essentially what they claim, they're going to believe it. And Iran is I think, very savvy in playing this card. I think it'll unfortunately probably work within their own,
right,
their own community.
Mentioned earlier about Germany and their reaction. It does say that the foreign minister of Germany, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, summoned the ambassador from Iran to his offices, and he said he wanted to make it, quote, unmistakably clear, unquote, about his government's displeasure over his remarks.
Excellent.
So his government, the German government, was outraged by what the guy said.
That's what I hope.
They just changed governments recently, too. They just had an election and new governments in place. They were outraged by it, like most civilized peoples.
Right.
Sure.
Now, I'm curious to see where the conference goes, though. I mean, will real Holocaust historians attend? You know, what kind of proof are both sides going to offer if they do attend? You know, I as usual, though, I expect that the deniers will attempt to, they'll take some isolated yet accepted fact of the Holocaust and cast some doubt on it and try to prove to everyone that, if this little fact is in doubt, then of course the whole house of cards is in doubt, which of course is ridiculous. It's like evolution.
It's remarkably similar to evolution.
It is.
It very is. I mean, you try to cast doubt on one theory, and they don't realize that it's so many, so many intersecting lines of reasoning and experiments and observations that just by knocking down one does literally nothing to the edifice.
In fact, creationism and intelligent design is best understood and described as evolution denial. That's what it is. Because they don't have any positive theory to put forward themselves.
That's right.
Excellent. I
think I have to give credit to Michael Shermer for coining that particular phrase, evolution denial.
That's exactly
what
he
did in Why People Believe Weird Things, but which I think does hit it right on the head. That's all it is. It's evolution denial, and denial is a type of pseudoscience. I've written about. I wrote an article about this, about denial as a type of pseudoscience, and evolution denial and Holocaust denial. There's also other things. There's HIV denial, people who do not think that HIV causes AIDS.
How about psychology denial?
There's mental illness denial, which I wrote about as well. And they all show remarkably similar features and logical fallacies and strategies. So there is a very deep analogy to be made between the creationist ID crowd and the Holocaust, denial crowd. As you say, just to pull out one example, you know, and based upon what you were saying, Bob, often like creationists will say, show me one piece of evidence that proves evolution happened. And the Holocaust deniers will say, show me one piece of evidence that proves that the Holocaust happened. But that is not a fair or a fair request to make, because there is no single piece of evidence that could possibly establish such a complex long historical event as either, you know, the evolution of life on Earth or even the Holocaust. It wasn't an event. You know, it was hundreds of events, thousands of events.
Well, that were systematic genocide over a period of almost
years.
A decade.
Yeah.
And they're tied together in a very loose and complicated way. It is true, for example, and the Holocaust deniers will point this out, that, you know, there is no document with Adolf Hitler's signature on it that says "kill all the Jews." You know, that document does not exist. There probably never was such a document.
No, but there is evidence of the Wannsee Conference,
of course,
where they decided on their final solution.
Of course, but you have to sort of infer what they mean. You know, what does it mean to rip the Jewish community out of Germany by the roots, to ausrotten, you know, the Jews from Germany? Does that mean to kill them, or does it mean just to get them out of every nook and cranny and send them to someplace else, for example? I mean, these are the kind of arguments the Holocaust deniers use. So, again, there's lots of, you know, wrinkles and complexity that they can argue around. Another example, which I think is, again, so similar to the kind of strategies that the ideers use. There are, you know, some of the concentration camps had gas chambers in them. You know, the Zyklon B, or was it Zyklon D? One of those.
Canisters of Zyklon B.
Zyklon B. Which is a type of cyanide. And they made the argument that, well, the amount of cyanide that was discovered in the walls of these buildings is actually much, much less than the amount of cyanide that you would find, say, in a delousing chamber, you know, a chamber used to basically kill lice that are on clothing. And it makes it seem as if, well, there was such a small trace amount that it couldn't have possibly been used to kill humans if it wasn't enough to kill lice. In fact, the amount of cyanide you need to kill lice is about 100 times the amount that you need to kill a person. So they just sort of, that selective reporting of these factoids, which seem to cast doubt on the official version of events, but not really put in the proper or full context. It's really meant to deceive. You know, there's like these facts which are true, but are presented in such a way that are meant to deceive, not to really to illuminate what actually happened. So that's basically the intellectual level that we're dealing with, you know, both with the ideas and, in this case, now with Holocaust denial.
It's a conclusion looking for evidence. It's outrageous.
Exactly, right.
Well, the other similarity that I think is interesting is, you know, should real historians attend this conference?
Right, which is the same dilemma we talked
like
about with the ID. You know, should real biologists grace it with
their presence?
I'm
starting to think yes. I mean, it's such a pernicious and widespread belief. I mean, you got to represent and show people that, you know, maybe for the first time, you know, the other side of the story that they...
Yeah,
they
yeah but
really
don't they become kind of a useful idiot at that point? I mean, really, Iran has a totally different... They don't really care what happened with the Holocaust, whether it happened or not. They really don't. That's not the real purpose behind all of this. They're trying to grab... grab headlines.
Which they will do, however, in any case. And I think that's the demarcation line.
If
you're going to... by your attention, your presence, whatever, elevate an event or a claim or an organization or whatever out of obscurity into public awareness, then I would say you're better off just ignoring them. But if something already has the public attention, like certainly ID does in this country and certainly Holocaust denial does in Iran and maybe the broader Islamic world, then I don't think that you elevate it that much by your presence. I think that because they will make a lot out of your absence. They say, oh, well, you know, again, they're just hiding from the truth. They don't even, you know, they don't even have faith enough in their claims that they will come and confront the real facts. So they'll make plenty of hay out of the absence of genuine historians. I think that probably the optimal thing to happen is for historians which are not only well-versed in the history of the Holocaust, but well-versed in Holocaust denial and the strategies employed by Holocaust deniers to go there and kick their butts. That's what I think is probably the best-case scenario. I don't think that it's going to, you know, essentially decline into obscurity if they just refuse to go. I don't think that strategy will work, in my opinion. And again, I would draw the same analogy to creations of an ID in this country. For example, with the two recent court cases, the one in Dover and then the one before that, which was, where was that? The one court case where the evolutionists, the scientists, essentially refused to give their testimony.
Oh, no, that was in Kansas.
Was that Kansas?
Kansas.
And
yeah, I think so. Kansas.
And then, that's right, you're right. They basically boycotted it, and I don't think that really worked. And then the one in Dover, which was a much more, you know, important precedent, the scientists did show up, the evolutionists, and they completely destroyed the ideas. So, you know, I think if you just take those two most recent cases as an example, I think the strategy of confronting them with people who know what they're doing is probably the way to go. All right, well, before we close tonight, we're actually a little bit over, so we'll have to cut to our last topic. I wanted to mention the South Korean stem cell researcher, Dr. Wang, who is under now intense investigation, both by the university where he, which is a Seoul National University where he works, the Korean government, the, you know, international scientists, the journals that published his papers,
basically
not only
everybody.
Basically everybody. So, yeah. Again, for those of you who are living in a cave, this is the South Korean stem cell researcher who some of his co-workers expressed some doubts about perhaps some of the legitimacy of some of the elements of the paper that he published. And over time, the accusations just got worse and worse and worse, and it turns out that he completely fabricated some of the alleged stem cell, you know, lines that he had reported that he had created. And, you know, the more that the investigation that had been done, the more his work was essentially unraveling as a big fraud. This is really, you know, a shocking and very disheartening episode. Obviously, the practice of science depends greatly upon the honesty, you know, of individuals and practitioners. And I do think the good news is that, you know, science is self-correcting.
Right.
Over time, unless something is true, you know, it won't hold up over time. Because people are going to always, you know, try to replicate your research and, you know, base further research on the discoveries and on the findings. And if it turns out that it's in fact not true, it just, over time, it'll seem more.
That's what the whole peer review process.
Right.
Does.
Well, peer review is not exactly the same thing. I mean, what I'm talking about is more replication. The idea that over time, any fraudulent findings will be more and more at odds at new discoveries that are being made. The thing that comes to mind is Piltdown Man, which was a famous, you know, English fraudulent early human fossil that turned out to be fake. It was, like, I think, an orangutan jaw and a human skull. But
cold fusions.
It was, yeah. Well, cold fusion as well. That fell apart because it, you know, the people could not replicate it. You know, after Piltdown Man was discovered, it basically fit the bias as to what scientists thought early man should look like, but then over the next 20, 30 years, the more fossils that were discovered, the more out of line the Piltdown fossils were, until they were such an anomaly that they were really irrelevant, that everyone basically discounted them as some kind of anomaly. They couldn't fit into the rest of the evidence. And then eventually, of course, it was discovered that it was a fraud.
So you're saying that science eventually weeds out.
Yeah, I mean, it has to weed out any wrong idea. So fraud, you know, of course, they're very counterproductive. They cause tremendous inefficiency. I mean, you could think that people may base their career choices on, you know, on findings that may turn out to be fraudulent. But they do get worked out over time. The peer review process is more immediate. That's, you know, if you submit a paper for publication in a journal, a peer-reviewed journal, then relevant experts are asked to review the research to make sure that it's up to snuff, that it meets, you know, scientific and academic standards, that nothing seems fishy. But, you know, they don't go to your lab and look at your notebooks and interrogate people. You know, it's not the kind of investigation that would root out fraud necessarily. You know what I mean? It really is more just, it's assuming basically that you're honest, but just looking at the academic standards of what you're doing. Are your arguments sound? Does the evidence say what you say it says? Did you forget to account for any possible explanations? Did you, were your controls adequate? Whatever, you know. They're basing it on the what's written in front of them largely.
But in the case of Dr. Wang, I guess it was some of his students that...
Yeah,
that narked on him.
Basically, and then it first I think came to media attention when an American researcher, his involvement was in the writing of the paper. He wasn't ever in Korea. He didn't do any of the research. He just put his name on the paper because he helped them write it, and that's perfectly legitimate. That happens all the time. You know, that's part of your intellectual contribution to the project is in putting it together in paper form, which is very important. But then some of Dr. Wang's junior colleagues reported to the American scientist who was involved that they had doubts about the legitimacy of some of the research. So he, of course, did not want his name attached to a fraudulent paper. So he pulled his name from the paper. That prompted the media attention. That prompted the investigation. And then the house of cards came down, just collapsed. The amazing thing, really, is that this guy thought he would get away with it.
Yeah.
The process is such that these things do tend to get found out over time. I mean, it's hard to really, especially in such a high-profile area. Now, if you're doing some really exotic, low-profile research and you're publishing in some obscure journal, you may get away with it, the Journal of Obscurity. But if you're publishing stem cell research in a prestigious journal and you essentially become the face of cutting-edge research for your country, I mean, how did he ever think that he was going to survive the close scrutiny that would engender?
He must have been in just
Korea,
a deep state of denial.
I guess.
I mean, Korea really lionizes their heroes, and he was a hero to that country.
Absolutely.
My God, he was a super rock star, that country, and now he's... he must be a total pariah.
As high as he was, he is now just as low, because now he turned from a national hero to a national disgrace. Absolutely. South Korea, which was enjoying, the limelight of being on the cutting edge of stem cell research, especially with, the Bush administration's stance and hampering stem cell research in this country, it was their opportunity to grab an early lead in this cutting-edge science, and now their whole program is derailed. I mean, they'll survive this, and cloning and stem cell research will survive all of this, but it really is a shame and is an absolute disgrace. My concern is that... When episodes like this come to light, it really tarnishes the reputation of the whole endeavor of science. That's probably the worst thing that can come out of all of this, is that the public attitude towards science as an institution is tarnished. And that can have a ripple effect, which can be tremendous.
No question about it. The enemies of science will use this episode
in their
favor, clearly.
Just like creationists still use Piltdown Man as an example. I mean, all those evolutionists just, don't know what they're talking about. They keep putting forward these fraudulent fossils like Piltdown Man. Yeah, that was like 100 years ago, and it was scientists who exposed it. So, when they try to use these examples of why science doesn't work, they're actually always, the ones we know about,
right,
of course, are examples of how science does work. Science weeded these things out. Of course, we don't know about the ones that haven't been weeded out, although we do have to trust to just, again, the replication and the process over time. Again, science, oftentimes the public has this sort of archaic view of science that it's the lone genius struggling away in their laboratory and then coming up with an amazing discovery, when in fact it is such a community effort. It really is a group effort of many, many, many individuals and institutions, each contributing little pieces and building on each other's work. So it's really hard, no one researcher, no one lab has such a huge control or influence over any area of research that they really could, hijack the path that research takes, or they could carry out a long, a fraudulent research program, because there's just too many other people would have to be involved. So it really was not sustainable. And again, as this episode demonstrates. I hate to end on a sour note, but we are out of time. Guys, Evan, Perry, Bob, thanks again for joining me.
Good episode,
thank you.
Guys.
Yeah,
very
it was
good.
A lot of fun. Bob, again, really good job on the science or fiction.
Thank you.
But, you know, I kind of was lofting you a softball with the whole black hole thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, he took the easy answer.
That's a special interest of yours, so I knew that was...
Still impressive. Still
but
impressive.
It was absolutely... it was a very impressive performance this week. So before we close next week, Perry,
yes.
you lined up a very interesting guest for us next week. Why don't you tell us about that briefly?
Yeah, a quick teaser for next week. We're going to have Eric Altman. He's the founder and president of the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society is going to be with us.
He promises to have startling new evidence for the existence of Bigfoot. Maybe.
Like a dead Bigfoot?
we'll have a lot of fun talking to him about Bigfoot. And there'll be other topics that we'll discuss as well next week. So definitely tune in. Sign up for that RSS feed and join us on the Skeptics Guide. So, guys, again, thanks. And to everyone out there, until next week, this is your Skeptics Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For more information about this and other episodes, visit our website at www.thenes.com. Theorem is performed by Kenetto and is used with permission.
That's last theorem. Let him far from the mainstream. Sleepless nights, slow burn days, problems.